What had been a rather dry summer in Wisconsin made a complete reversal in 2 weeks at the end of August. With record rainfall, drivers navigated flooded streets, neighbors helped neighbors stack sandbags high around homes and businesses. We watched the rising water and heard the accounts.
Right now at 5, it is flooding like they have never seen before in Dane County.
It's being called a summer's worth of rain in just one day.
Check out Black Earth Creek. It is at its banks along the side of the creek. You can actually see cars getting washed into the creek.
You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about flood management here in Wisconsin. The deadline is Monday for state residents to register for FEMA disaster assistance caused by the historic flooding in August and September. We're exploring lake levels, the water table, and how much control we can exercise over Mother Nature to prevent massive destruction from future floods. Chad Berginnis is executive director of the Association of State Floodplain Managers. The association promotes education and policies that mitigate the impacts of flooding. Chad, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate.
Well, let's look first here at Madison before we zoom out across the state. When we look at the historic flooding in and around Madison, a lot of finger pointing was at Lake Mendota's level. How much of an impact did this have on the historic flooding?
Lake levels can have an impact on flooding, but I think that probably misses the main narrative of the event that happened in August. The reality is when you get 10 inches of rain, mostly in about a 12-hour period, whether it be directly on the Yahara Lakes, whether it be on Black Earth Creek, or in just urban areas in Madison, lake levels play a very small role in terms of the overall impact of flooding. Now, the subsequent high water the rain event, when the lakes actually rose even more, of course, you did have property owners around the lakes having the effects of that. But again, when you have such a large event, you have to really look at the creeks, the rivers, the stormwater, as well as the lakes.
So there are a lot of other contributing factors, not just lake level. You mentioned runoff in urban development. What impact does runoff have on?
Well, runoff has a huge impact. Actually, our headquarters is right at the intersection of High Point and Mineral Point Road, where we saw a lot of the flooding. And in fact, I think a lot of the television stations were recording that area, Gammon Road. And that was all really stormwater runoff flooding. You know, in a lot of our communities, and Madison's not unique, we have stormwater systems that were developed in the 50s, 60s, 70s, that designs stormwater systems to handle a certain amount of flow. When there's more rain than the flow that they were designed to handle, you have flooding. And the trends that we are seeing today, where we're having more intense rainfall events, a lot of our stormwater systems, in not only in the state, but in the country, are inadequate.
So, and that runoff is going eventually to finding its way to river systems and to watersheds, and we're then seeing the rising water. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, so we, in managing this flood risk, you need to start with the urban runoff, but then you also need to look at your flood management along our rivers and our streams and our creeks in agricultural areas, and then finally further downstream. So it really takes an entire watershed approach to really manage flood risk comprehensively.
Give us some examples of what can happen in that watershed approach of management.
Well, the more progressive communities that we see in the nation really take an approach that starts even at the individual property level. You know, for example, in the city of Milwaukee and with the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District, they have a rain barrel program which tries to capture some of that stormwater on site at the source, so you have less water contributing to the runoff. And then you have community and municipal systems that convey water. They need to be sized properly. More of the progressive techniques these days are to not only retain and detain those, but to promote infiltration of water so that you also are having adequate water tables in time of drought. You have agricultural practices such as conservation tillage and things like that that actually can manage runoff even on farm fields. And so, again, it takes each of these approaches is one piece of the puzzle to solve our overall flood risk problem.
Chad Berginnis is with us. He's executive director of the Association of State Floodplain Managers, and we're talking about flood management in the state. Were you impacted by flooding over the summer? What part of the state do you live in, and how did the flooding impact your community? Has your community made substantial changes to the way it handles heavy rains? You can call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chad, as we were chatting here earlier, I had said that, you know, before Wisconsin, we'd lived in Louisiana, where for 15 years, where flooding happens. Flooding is almost, and I don't say it lightly, but flooding's a way of life. But coming here and seeing historic flooding and seeing the reactions by people and how they approach flooding seemed very different from what had happened in Louisiana. Can you tell us about some advancements here in Wisconsin?
Sure. You know, and Wisconsin actually does have some of those areas where flooding is a way of life. I was just reading an article recently about Soldiers Grove in Wisconsin, where prior to the effort to relocate part of the village in 1978, flooding was a way of life. It was described exactly how you said. But I think in Wisconsin, and Wisconsin is somewhat unique across the nation, Wisconsin has had progressive policies in place dealing with flood risk management for decades. Wisconsin, for example, with Soldiers Grove, probably had the nation's first attempt at relocating part of a community because of flood risk. In Darlington, Wisconsin, you had one of the nation's first comprehensive floodproofing of a historic downtown so that the businesses learn to live with the water but don't have the damage. So you have flood barriers set up for the individual businesses. The state also has been managing where folks build in relation to the floodplains through shoreline management and zoning, and also has a robust hazard mitigation program that addresses existing at-risk development and either buys them out, elevates them, relocates them, floodproofs them. And so put all those pieces together, and Wisconsin's done a great job of managing flood risk. And so when a big one actually happens, I think folks are really taken by surprise because we aren't used to that kind of flooding, because we have done quite a good job here in the state in managing that risk.
Well, and it's interesting you say that. Do communities in other parts of the state then approach flooding in different ways?
They do. I've been in flood risk management my entire career, and I've never seen two communities that were exactly alike. And each community's flood problems are unique, and the set of solutions to address those is also unique. One thing I've kind of said as a mantra through my career is that you can't address flood risk in a community through one approach. It really does take multiple approaches to do that.
Dane County has taken some recent steps to address flooding. The 2019 budget was approved last month, and it included $5 million for public works projects to address damage done by the August floods. We're talking about flood management, the ways it happens here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been affected by flooding? What part of the state do you live in? And how did the flooding impact your community? How has your community made changes in the way it handles heavy rainfalls? Chad Berginnis stays with us. He heads up the Association of State Floodplain Managers. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Dane County will allocate $3 million to improve water flow in the Yahara River and other so-called pinch points, enabling water to move more quickly out of Dane County's entire chain of lakes during and after heavy rain. It's one piece of the upcoming budget. We're talking about flood management and how communities around Wisconsin can manage water levels after historic rains. Chad Berginnis stays with us. He leads the Association of State Floodplain Managers. That's based here in Wisconsin and based here in Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see done to address flooding across Wisconsin? Do you have questions about how you and your community can better prepare for rising water in the future? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Chad, we have an email here coming in from Bruce, who'd like to hear your assessment of the impact loss of wetlands in Wisconsin that has had on the intensity and frequency of flooding events.
Sure. Well, wetlands really are our natural buffer when it comes to flooding. In addition to all the other benefits that they provide from water quality and habitat, flood management is actually one of those huge benefits. So while I don't particularly have facts at my fingertips in terms of wetlands loss in Wisconsin, generally speaking, the loss of wetlands usually means that you're going to have more stormwater entering our streams and rivers, and that's going to cause increased losses.
Let's talk for a moment about sandbagging, because oftentimes when we see that historic flooding coming in advance, you see people sandbagging. National Guard gets called up, and everyone helps everyone sandbag around their properties, around their businesses. First of all, is that the first line of defense?
Sandbagging is something that's probably the most common emergency action somebody takes in terms of dealing with imminent flooding and is a first line of defense. However, sandbagging from a technological standpoint is kind of old technology. And one of the things that we try to do at ASFPM is to also promote advancements in technologies that are out there. And so there are alternatives to sandbagging that are more environmentally friendly, that are reusable. And a lot of those products are ones that you can find. We actually have a small program called the National Flood Barrier Testing and Certification Program. And we test and certify these new technology products. And you can find those at nationalfloodbarrier.org. And basically, the reason that we do that is just to make sure they work as advertised. But for example, one of the products that exists out there is a flat system that you can literally unroll around your building, and then the weight of the water actually fills it up, elevates it, and then brings it down after the flood event. You rinse it off, you roll it back up, and you store it.
Wow.
And so that's something that takes a lot less labor. You don't have the environmental hazards of disposing of sandbag waste, and you can reuse it over and over.
And that's on the market right now?
And that's on the market right now, yes.
Have we been seeing businesses and even personal homes take other approaches than sandbagging? Or is this hard? Is it slow to come on?
You know, it seems to be slow to come on, but I think it's also because that they're really... there's no good place for the public to go and find these kinds of resources. And so that's part of the reason we started our testing and certification program, because at the website, for example, you can find all of those products that are tested and certified. And that the testing we do is to a standard. It's an ANSI standard 2510, which is a consensus standard that is being adopted actually by other countries in the world as well. So again, you know, would encourage folks to at least check that out for some alternatives.
How realistic is it? We're seeing communities dedicating millions of dollars to work on repairing what has been damaged and also future mitigation efforts. How can you expect communities to afford big changes to control flooding in the future?
Well, not to be punny, but that's probably the million-dollar question, actually. The costs are going up. From a national trends, here's something that we're seeing. In the 1990s, in the nation, we averaged about $5.5 billion of flooding per year. In the 2000s, that jumped to $10 billion a year. Probably in this decade, by the time it's over with, we're probably going to be approaching $20 billion a year in terms of flood damages. Not only are these affecting budgets locally, but these are going to have a real impact even on our national economy. And so the approaches that we take to flood risk management are things that we need to seriously think about and potentially change. And so, for example, at their very core, flood risk areas are high hazardous areas. And sometimes it may make sense to put our development, our critical infrastructure, outside of the floodplain.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Jeff joining us from Delafield. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My question is in regards to what I'll call modern agricultural practices of tiling more and more of the farm fields. Isn't that kind of equivalent to eliminating a wetland where you're taking away the water's ability to infiltrate and you're just sending it into the streams and rivers, which I would think would increase the probability of flooding downstream? Thank you.
Yeah, Jeff, thanks for the call.
Yes, actually, it would have a similar impact and perhaps even a broader impact, because a farm field that you're going to tile, you're going to be usually tiling a lot more acreage than you would, let's say, eliminating a wetland. And again, the effect of tiling is to remove the water faster and get it into our streams and our rivers faster. And that concentrates the stormwater. So better approaches would be using things like conservation tillage and no-till, which have been proven to increase water infiltration by a significant amount.
Let's go to Harry now in Madison. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I have a question. Isn't it true that the state enacted laws to overrule strict stormwater retention requirements that were enacted in Dane County? I mean, I think basically Dane County, which is developing rapidly, enacted an ordinance to say that new development, they needed to, the new development would have to not increase the stormwater runoff. And I think the state said that local ordinances could not be stricter than the state law on that.
Harry, thanks so much for the call. What is that interplay between ordinances and how we manage water?
Yeah, so you know, one of the things that is frustrating from a flood risk management standpoint is that when states do enact laws that would prohibit communities who want to be maybe more stringent, be more proactive, for them to do so. Because what we see in the nation is that probably the leading innovations happen at that local level. And so again, when you have actions like that, they're really stifling the innovation that's happening in the community. And that in turn could have a potential of increasing flood risk.
We hear of 100-year flood events. We hear of 500-year flood events. Mm-hmm. Where do the help us understand that terminology?
Well, the basic origin of that terminology is when you say, for instance, a 100-year flood event, it has, on average, an event that happens once every 100 years, or it's a 1% chance any given year. And so it's a way to communicate risk, but it's also not the greatest way to communicate risk. Unfortunately, professionals in the field, like our organization and others, we've been debating this a long time, whether or not we should go to a different way of explaining it. The problem is, how do you explain it in a way that compels people to take action? You know, the folks down in Houston, Texas, and the fallacy of using this language, in Houston, prior to Harvey, suffered a 100-year flood, a 500-year flood, and another 500-year flood the 3 years before Harvey.
Mm. So suddenly that language just doesn't seem relevant anymore and doesn't make an impact, and it perhaps goes in contrast to what the language is.
Well, right.
The definition is.
And especially in the face of another trend that is really altering flood risk in the country, and that's climate change, and specifically the two parts of climate change. One, we don't have to worry about here in Wisconsin, which is sea level rise, but the other is the increase in very heavy precipitation events. When you look at the National Climate Assessment Report that we prepare in the United States every 4 years or so, one of the more interesting graphics is it shows the Midwest, and it basically shows a 37% increase in very heavy precipitation events now versus in the previous period of record. And anecdotally, I'm hearing that from our members all over the country, not only here in Wisconsin, but elsewhere. You know, whereas maybe growing up, folks thought, you know, a good rain is a 1 or 2 inch rain. And these days, when we get rain, we're talking 4, 5, and 6 inches.
Well, Chad, thank you so much for joining us and helping us learn a little bit today about flood management.
Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate it.
Chad Berginnis is Executive Director of the Association of State Floodplain Managers. The association promotes education and policies that mitigate the impacts of flooding. Up next, it's news. Then we'll speak with Democratic U.S. Representative Mark Pocan about what's ahead for the 116th Congress. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Congressman Mark Pocan announced recently he will no longer accept donations from corporate political action committees to fund his reelection campaign. At least 36 other House Democrats have made the same pledge. Pocan represents the 2nd Congressional District, including Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. He co-chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and he joins us on the line from Washington for a year-end conversation about the big issues swirling around Capitol Hill. Congressman Pocan, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with this whole border wall situation, budget situation. President Trump said yesterday he'd do whatever it takes to get border security, and it seems there's this deepening divide over the border wall funding with a week to go before a partial government shutdown, and Democrats said yesterday they won't budge. So how much should Congress be willing to give the president on a border wall to avoid a partial shutdown?
Well, the problem is, I mean, this is a divide between Donald Trump and the rest of the world, especially when it comes to all of Congress. In the last appropriations process, and let's remember that Republicans are in charge of the House and the Senate and the White House, explicitly in the language for additional protections for the border, it said no money can go to any designs created after March of 2017. That's exactly when the designs for the wall came out. So even the Republicans understand that it is a waste of money and it's not necessary to have a wall. And in fact, last winter, Chuck Schumer offered a small amount, and many of us weren't real pleased with that. And Donald Trump didn't take yes for an answer then, because I think he likes to talk about the wall more than even he believes the wall is necessary. So right now, we came to this week. We've got, I think, 7 agencies that just to finish the funding through September 30th, one of them being Homeland Security. The wall issue came up again, and the president has decided that he's willing to shut government down if he doesn't get his way, even though Democrats and Republicans in Congress together have said we don't want funding going there. So it's kind of an odd place. It's kind of up to the president to decide if he's going to continue to hold his breath. But, you know, I think Congress has already stated what we want to do, and I think we're waiting for the president's call.
So where are you on this? How do you see these negotiations ending, and how will you vote?
Well, I think Nancy Pelosi actually has put out a good suggestion for where we're at with Congress about to change leadership in the House, and you know, again, the president being the outlier on this. She's recommended we just do a continuing resolution that continues the funding for Homeland Security as is through September 30th, so we don't have to have a debate about other things. And I think that would be a reasonable way to wrap up the year and get into a new session and start right. But, you know, Donald Trump, I always think he comes at this job first as a reality show star, second as a businessman, third as the president of the United States. And this week he certainly showed the reality show star aspect of him. He loves the ratings. He loves the drama. I think now we're just waiting to see if some of the Republicans might be able to privately talk him off of the drama side of this and maybe move us forward so that, you know, we can get the work done that we have to do.
Let's move on and talk about the Farm Bill. Congress reached a compromise on the Farm Bill this week. Senate passed the bill Tuesday, and then the House voted overwhelmingly to support it Wednesday. You were among the yes votes. Some say it doesn't do much to change how farm subsidies are allocated, that it will continue to divert money away from rural communities. Do you see that as a weakness in the 2019 bill?
Well, you know, when you have, again, the Congress that is tough to get anything through, you have to have compromises. So this represents more of what we've seen previously in a farm bill. The worst thing we could have, though, is not having a farm bill, period. It would create lots of damaging potential for all sorts of different industries in the agricultural industry. So, you know, it really was important that something got done. So the fact that we're even now doing it at the very end of the year rather than when it needed to happen, you know, I guess the positive is we're moving forward. But it is crucial to have many of the aspects in there that are in there. Is it perfect? None of these bills ever are perfect. People can always find a reason to vote no. But in general, we fought back the cut to the food stamp program, the SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, that Republicans had been really fighting for all year, so that, you know, really poor people still can get food assistance. It's the single best program that keeps kids out of poverty. It has a number of other strong provisions for ag and some new ones even that we've put forward. So I think on the whole, you saw the vast majority of Congress voted for it. And, you know, again, this is stuff that we should be able to get done in the normal procedures. And, you know, since 2010, Congress has been pretty severely broken. So, you know, I think people were glad to move ahead and at least get something done that had to pass.
Well, aside from the food stamps, some conservative Republicans are saying it goes way too far in expanding federal subsidies to more distant relatives of farmers, like cousins and nephews and nieces. Why was this part of the package? Does it go too far in expanding loopholes for farm subsidies?
So that provision, they gave us the exact number of people affected, but it's an incredible small part of the overall farm bill. The bigger parts of the farm bill, without question, is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And, Kate, my first session in Congress, when they were fighting it at that point, I actually lived on the SNAP benefit for a week. So back then, it was $31 for a week for an individual. It's actually decreased because of Republican actions since then, even though inflation's gone up. So, you know, those were the really big, weighty issues of the farm bill. And, you know, while any bill that's a big bill like this is going to have provisions you can point to that aren't perfect, am I going to take food away from children because of it? I think that would be a really bad idea.
Talking with Mark Pocan, a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. You have a line at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for Congressman Pocan? What is the right answer for how you see health care, for instance? Are you in favor of the Affordable Care Act? How do you see Congress's role in foreign relations, in trade? And what about the Green New Deal? What actions would you like Congress to take up on climate change. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Congressman, let's go on to talking about the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which you co-chair. You have one senator on the caucus, 78 House members. Where do you see your caucus going, and is it going to gain any traction heading into the 116th Congress?
Yeah, actually, we have a bunch of new members that are joining, and actually some people who've been around for quite a while, people like Earl Blumenauer from Oregon, who's been around for a long time, is joining, as well as Brad Sherman from California, some other people. So we're actually at about 90 to 95 members now.
Ah, so you need to update your website.
Yeah, well, it would be in the 116th, right?
For the current Congress. Yeah. Okay, all right. Carrie, so you're growing is what you're saying. What is the caucus focused on?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we are, so there's certain values-based caucuses in Congress. There's the Blue Dogs, which is the more conservative caucus. That's about 25 people. There's the New Dems, which is a more moderate, kind of corporate-friendly caucus, and that's about 60 members. And then there's our caucus. And I think, you know, we fight for a lot of proposals that are more progressive, things like trying to make sure that everyone has access to health care, things like debt-free college proposals, things like investing substantially in our infrastructure so that, you know, we're $4.6 trillion deficit right now to bring it up to grade, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers. So there's a number of proposals that we put out, and, you know, going into the next Congress, we're going to have 13 of our members who are committee chairs with the Democrats taking over. So we're in a good place to actually govern, and we're really excited about that.
I want to pick your brain on this. You've been very critical and vocal about the Problem Solvers Caucus and the group No Labels. Where do caucuses go wrong, and how will you avoid those pitfalls?
Yes, I think, you know, this is one where I joined because, you know, Reid Ribble, who used to represent the Green Bay area, was a very good friend, and he's a very good person and sincerely wanted to see us get things done. His ideas were my ideas in that you find out what you've got in common, get those things done, and then you've got a basis to get the trickier stuff done. Pretty much a fourth grade, you know, understanding of how things should operate, right? Like, we all should understand that. The problem is, in this particular group, the group that's the sponsor of the Problem Solver Caucus, No Labels, proposed that that's what they were about, and then very quickly we saw a more corporate agenda out of them, like scaling back Social Security, you know, these different initiatives that weren't really what they said they were about. We thought it was to get us to get to know each other and work together. And then they started endorsing in political campaigns and putting money behind people, which is something they never proposed to us. And then I made a simple request that a constituent gave me, which is, where does their money come from? I asked that, and the answer was stunning, Kate. The answer was, well, we'll quietly take you off of our list. Like, in other words, how dare you ask where our support comes from? Well, you know, right off the bat, that's a huge red flag. And then quickly we started seeing other things they've done. And it turns out that they have a very different agenda than what they proposed. So it's not just me. You know, Jared Huffman from California, Alan Lowenthal from California, others of us from my class that joined, all have said we're no longer a part of it because they really kind of lied to us about what it was about. So, you know, that's the problem. You know, I think for the Progressive Caucus, we don't have a single sponsoring group. We've been around for a very long time. But, you know, that's something you have to be very careful of when a group comes in. What is the real agenda? Mm-hmm. Which is one of the reasons why you brought up earlier, you know, I've decided to quit taking corporate money. I want to be able to show that without question, any decision I make is not being influenced by outside money. Previously, only five people in the entire House of Representatives didn't take corporate money, but the new incoming class, 36 people did. So I have to admit, I was inspired. If 10% of Congress operates this way, we can change how Washington works. So I just think, you know, often follow the money, whether it be in a caucus or in other venues, that's so often what's wrong with Washington, D.C.
We're talking with Democratic Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. You have a line, by the way, 800-642-1234. How do you want him to vote on immigration legislation? What do you want him to know about the latest farm bill? And what should he know about your farming operation? What's the right answer you see for health care? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. The new 235-member Democratic majority is set to take power in the U.S. House of Representatives on January 3rd. It could be the most progressive Democrats on Capitol Hill in decades. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Representative Mark Pocan on the line, and he represents the 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. It's a year-end conversation about the issues he's working on in Washington, and you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for the congressman? What issue is forefront on your mind? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's move on to trade. Shipping costs from China to the U.S. have more than doubled year over year, and we've been locked in this tit-for-tat fight, levying tariffs on each other's imports worth billions of dollars. We're feeling it here in Wisconsin. What role does Congress have in getting us out of a trade war with China?
So this is one of those areas that is very hard to describe because, you know, Donald Trump promised when he ran in Wisconsin, when he ran for president across the country, a very specific kind of 30,000-foot vision of trade, which was bringing jobs back to America. And I think that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why he won Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, and those are the states that gave him the White House. The problem is he got in, and he really doesn't have a comprehensive understanding of trade. So, you know, he's used tariffs very kind of haphazardly against countries. Generally, you use them when someone's breaking the rules, but he's used them with even friendly countries. And at the end of the day, we wound up in a much worse place because he doesn't understand trade well enough. And, you know, now we've got another little timeout with China. But at the same time, we're watching what's happening right now in the stock market and other business kind of indicators of trade policy. So, you know, what we need is to recognize we do have a world with global trade, but we also have to have standards within that trade. And I think what we're waiting to see is a real vision out of the Trump administration. I think I've seen a better vision out of some of the staff that work for the White House on this than I have the president. But it certainly is not like a white-black issue when it comes to this president. It's a very, very murky gray, and it's hard for either side to really define what he's trying to do when it comes to trade.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Valerie, who's joining us from Fond du Lac. Hi, Valerie.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just had my question to the immigration topic that you're talking about. I was thinking maybe we should just give them a temporary work pass for 5 years here and see how they do, because we're moving all our jobs over to Mexico anyway. People are moving them for cheap labor, and they work for cheap labor anyway. So, I mean, to make the United States stronger, building a relationship like that and passing a bill like that, that happened maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was the same thing that happened like that, where they passed a bill where they're allowed to stay here in the United States for a couple of years and have a working pass, see how they do.
Valerie, thanks so much for the call. Representative Pocan, what are your thoughts here?
Yeah, Valerie, let me answer it this way. I think what a lot of us would like to see, and by a lot I mean people in both parties, would like to see is have a real debate over comprehensive immigration reform, because I think what you point out very validly is that, you know, talking about whether it be just a wall or just the DACA students or youth or just one aspect of immigration leaves a bunch of holes. And we have a reality of there's, what, 11 to 13 million people who are undocumented who currently are here. How do you deal with that huge issue in amongst all of this? My first session in Congress two sessions ago, there was a bipartisan compromise that came out of the Senate. It wasn't perfect, but it was a very good effort. It had 70 votes, so it was a strong bipartisan effort. We need to go back to doing that and dealing with immigration reform that provides a pathway to citizenship for aspiring Americans through a very rigorous process, but also has some additional protections at the borders. That is what we really need to do, and not just a wall or just this or just that. And I think that is the best effort. So whether it be your suggestion or other suggestions that are out there, we have to deal with it in a comprehensive way, or else we're always going to be playing whack-a-mole and never quite getting it right.
Do you think Democrats are on the same page about how to handle immigration?
I think, you know, again, I like to just look at that. You know, I look back two sessions, and if you could have a bill that had 70 votes in the Senate, especially these days in Congress, that should give it a huge gravitas. It may not be perfect. It may be a good starting point. I'm sure we're going to tweak it because now we're, you know, different people are in Congress from the last couple sessions. But it showed that there was a path to doing this, and I think we need to go back and look at that rather than just holding our breath for funding for a wall and then not dealing with all the other aspects of immigration. So, you know, I think that's, to me, a good starting point since it already had that much work put into it. Mm. And then, you know, now we've got split government again, that may be a good time to get things done. I remember of my 14 years in the Wisconsin legislature, 10 of them were with split government. That's how most of the time is, and you're almost more likely to get things done sometimes in that way. So I'm hopeful that we can try to have those debates, but I do have to admit, you know, we run into a stumbling block on the president because he feels very, very strongly on this issue.
Let's bring in Scott in Madison with thoughts. Hi, Scott.
Hey, hi there. Hey, I have a question, and this may sound stupid, but it's just an idea. Why aren't we using, like, the El Chapo cartel, drug money or something for this wall? I mean, there's got to be other fun stuff available out there, and I know it sounds off the wall, but it's actually truthful that we're collecting these funds from, you know, these illegal drug runners and stuff. That's a lot of money. I mean, we could be using stuff like that for this wall.
Scott, thanks for the call. Where are we at with whether Mexico will pay for this wall? We've heard conflicting stories on that.
Yeah, well, and that's the point that Scott brought up that I think is, you know, probably the initial start of this conversation was the president said he was going to make Mexico pay for a wall. Now, of course, that was on the assumption that it was people from Mexico coming here, when we know now it's really people from Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, primarily because of violence and other issues in those countries. But he did say Mexico is going to pay for it, and now we're all being asked to pay for it. And, you know, even just the $5 billion that he's asking for is $5 billion. It can do a lot of other good in the country rather than just building a wall. So, you know, I think a lot of us are saying we don't even need a wall per se. We do need additional security protections, and we've done that in, you know, restoring some fencing. There's now things like drones and other ways you can do short of having a wall. But make that part of that total discussion around comprehensive immigration reform that also recognizes the people who live here. And in some cases, like the DACA recipients, you know, you may have been here since you're 2 weeks old or 2 months old. You don't even know the country or speak the language from which your parents brought you. There's no reason to say you're going to deport someone like that.
Let's look at health care for a moment. One of the policies you've said the your caucus will promote within the Democratic Party is Medicare for All. And the Affordable Care Act has been under fire, has experienced an incredible amount of pushback from Republicans. How would you get people on board for Medicare for All? Is that really a reality?
So this is one where, you know, we have a lot of education to do for members of Congress. The good news is we don't necessarily have education for real people. There was a Reuters poll about now maybe 2 months ago that showed 70% of Americans support Medicare for All, including 52% of Republicans, because people realize that this is a crazy issue, that you should be able to go bankrupt because you're ill or that you couldn't get coverage prior to the Affordable Care Act if you actually had an illness or a pre-existing condition. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act did a number of really good things, including making sure that anyone with a pre-existing condition could get coverage, making sure that women were paying the same as men, you know, making sure that you had preventive care and a whole bunch of other things. But it has fallen apart in that there were a death by a thousand cuts in the last several Congresses to it. And there are some real issues around the deductibles and issues that we have to address. That's why people look at, you know, Canada is not a third world country. Europe is not a third world continent. We need to recognize that other countries can get health care for their citizenry, and it's not that difficult, and yet it's something that affects every single family.
Congressman,
I guess public opinion polls show support for it.
Congressman, really quickly, 10 seconds, what is your New Year's resolution for Congress?
Just to finally start working. It's been a tough 6 years there with very little moving, and I'm hoping with Democrats in charge, we can try to get at least a few more ideas passed in Congress and moving forward.
Representative Pocan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. Appreciate it.
Mark Pocan is Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. He joined us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Ideas Network.